Good morning. I add my words of appreciation to those that have already been spoken for the presence of all who are here this morning. As Ron mentioned, we do have a number of people who are gone. I can look over the audience and I can see somewhat predictably who would be gone, those who have parents that they went to see or children that they went to see. But one of the good things about holidays, that's the bad thing. One of the good things is that people come to town. And we do have a number of visitors with us this morning. We want you to know that we're happy that you come our way, and we invite you back to be with us every opportunity that you have. If you would turn to Jeremiah chapter 12 as we get started this morning. Jeremiah chapter 12, we're going to talk this morning about Jeremiah and the feelings that he had that are expressed in this passage. Man, what a difference a week makes, huh? Coming to church last Sunday morning, you feel like you need a coat. Today, you feel like you need a t-shirt. It was so warm. And I'm sure it'll do nothing but get warmer. But nice to have the wind blowing at least and keeping things a little bit cooler. But it's always nice in the house of God. What a blessing we have to be able to have the kind of facility that we have with these padded pews and the air conditioning system and all of those kind of things that we have. We can heat ourselves in the winter, cool ourselves in the summer. And as I think about that, and as Zach mentioned in both his opening comments in the Bible class this morning and in his prayer, what we're doing this morning, as we come here in comfort, and especially as we come here without any kind of fear that we're going to be somehow persecuted for that, we owe to so many who have sacrificed their lives for this freedom that we have. And I'm talking about both in the Memorial Day aspect that we'll be celebrating tomorrow, those soldiers and others who've given their life so that we can have these freedoms that we have, most importantly, the freedoms to serve Jesus Christ without any kind of fear of somehow being persecuted for that, being molested for that. But most especially, and as Zach mentioned, most especially the death of Jesus Christ, because without his death, it wouldn't make any difference. What we're doing here this morning, the songs that we're singing, the prayers that we have offered up, and our study of God's Word wouldn't make any difference at all. Those who come to God must believe that he is, that he exists, and that he is a rewarder of those who diligently seek him. Our God is a good God. And he evidenced that most in the sending of his Son to die on that cross some 2,000 years ago, so that we, through that shed blood, might approach our God for the forgiveness of sins that he offers. I'm glad I'm here this morning, and I hope that you are glad as well. The Old Testament prophets were known for extraordinary patience. But every once in a while, we read of a prophet who just kind of reached the end of his rope. And patience kind of ran out. And it is interesting to read those passages because not only in the way that they react, but in the way that God responds to them, we see something interesting about them, but I think we can see something interesting about ourselves as well. And we can learn something about what happens when we kind of reach the end of our rope in the way that maybe our society is, or whatever struggles that we are having in this life. There can come those times when we've just had about all that we can take. And so as we read these prophets and the things that they went through and how they dealt with and how God responded to them reaching the end of their rope, it'll help us to determine how we need to respond, what the answer is when we reach the end of our rope as well. a number of prophets, we read, came to kind of the end of their rope. They ran out of patience. Typically, they ran out of patience with the people of God because the people of God would not follow them in the kind of faith that they had. Read of Moses in Numbers chapter 20. When he reached the end of his rope with the people's complaining, and he spoke words, Psalm 106 says, he said things that were not honorable to God, did not manifest the position of God. He spoke rashly with his lips, is what the psalmist says in that passage. He ran out of patience with the people of God, and as a result of that, he didn't get to enter into the promised land. Perhaps the most striking example of someone who just finally reaches the end of their rope is Elijah in 1 Kings chapter 19. This great, strong, extraordinary prophet of God reaches a point in his life because of the reaction that he is receiving from these so many years that he has been preaching, and especially as he challenges the prophets of Baal and defeats them, and everything seems to be going like the people of God are going to follow his lead and they're going to turn their lives around. And then Jezebel puts out a contract on his head, and he has to flee for his life. And there in 1 Kings 19, he goes into a cave, and he just wants to end it all. Lord, please take my life. And God there in that passage tells him to leave the cave and to get to work because there are things that need to be done. And then in Habakkuk, the book of Habakkuk, as we'll note in our study of the minor prophets, and we'll come to Habakkuk in several weeks, maybe a month or two. Habakkuk wants to know in Habakkuk 1 when God is going to have enough of the people of God. When is he going to do something about the constant rebellion of God's people? And so it's not surprising when we see these kinds of occurrences that even someone like Jeremiah, as strong as Jeremiah is, reaches a point where he comes to the end of his rope. And that is what Jeremiah chapter 12, verses 1 through 5 is all about. Jeremiah has enough of these people to whom he has been sent with the message of God. Read with me, if you would. Jeremiah chapter 12, beginning at verse 1. Jeremiah says, "Righteous are you, O Lord, when I plead with you. Yet let me talk with you about your judgments." He wants to have a dialogue with God about the judgments that God has made. And here's questions. Why does the way of the wicked prosper? Why are those happy who deal so treacherously? You have planted them. Yes, they have taken root. They grow. Yes, they bear fruit. You are near in their mouth, but far from their mind. But you, O Lord, know me. You have seen me. You have tested my heart toward you. Pull them out like sheep for the slaughter and prepare them for the day of slaughter. How long would the land mourn and the herbs of every field wither? The beasts and the birds are consumed for the wickedness of those who dwell there, because they said, he will not see our final end. If you have run with the footmen and they have wearied you, how then can you contend with horses? And if in the land of peace in which you trust, they wearied you, then how will you do in the floodplain of the Jordan? This is a picture of Jeremiah reaching the end of his rope with these people. Jeremiah preached in one of the most difficult times in all of Israel's history. He started his prophecy, Jeremiah 1 and verse 2 says, in the time of Josiah. And the thing about Josiah, as he was the king in the southern kingdom, is he was such a good king, perhaps second in line with David in his faith in God, his desire to be right with God and to lead the people of God. into a restoration of their hearts to God, and all of the things that go along with that, the repair of the temple and the reinstitution of worship to God and the sacrifices and all of those kinds of things. And Jeremiah was there when Josiah began to do those things. Imagine what a relief it must have been to Jeremiah. How Jeremiah's heart must have been filled with gladness to see a man like Josiah ascend the throne and do all of the things that Jeremiah was doing. And then after about 31 years, Josiah's reign comes to an end. And everything, The righteousness of the king, the righteousness of the people, the hope that Jeremiah had for this kingdom came unraveled when his son Jehoiakim ascended that throne. And it continued to unravel because of the constant wickedness of these sons of Josiah until the people are sent into captivity in Jerusalem. Is destroyed. And Jeremiah sees all of this. And even before it happens, before the people are taken into Babylonian captivity, before Jerusalem and the temple are destroyed, Jeremiah knows it's coming. If these people do not correct themselves, God's going to come down hard on them. Jeremiah knows that. God is being patient with these people. And he will continue to be patient with them for a period of time. But Jeremiah has run out of patience. In chapter 11, he preaches to the people in his hometown, Anathoth. And he tells them, God's angry with you. You're worshiping the Baals. And God will have none of that. He is jealous for you, and he is angry because you have committed this spiritual adultery against him. You've left off serving God and are beginning to serve the Baals. God is angry, he says in chapter 11 and verse 17. And what is the priest's response to that? The very people that you think would be most receptive to this? They tell Jeremiah, if you don't shut your mouth, we're going to kill you. Now imagine being in that kind of a situation. It is at this point when Jeremiah's life is threatened that Jeremiah there in chapter 12, as we have read, goes to God. And he goes to God with questions. Here's what Jeremiah wanted to know. One, why do good things happen to bad people? You know, there are kind of two twists to this good versus bad thing. Sometimes the question will be, why do bad things happen to good people? And that's a good question. But at other times, it is a question like this. Why do good things happen to bad people? And so Jeremiah is seeing all of the wickedness that is going on with the people. He's seeing how it has devastated the land. And yet they seem to be prospering. Everything seems to be going okay for them. And Jeremiah wants to know from God, why are you letting that happen? Good question. And it's a question that Asaph in Psalm chapter 73 asks of God. That whole chapter of Psalm chapter 73 is written by this leader of Israel who wants to know why God allows good things to continue to happen to those that Asaph knows are not in obedience to the will of God. And he says his questions became so significant. He so did not understand it, he said his feet came close to slipping. He almost gave up his faith. And he says, I can't ask anybody about it. I can't share with anybody my concerns about this and how close I am to just giving up, he says, because I'm a leader in Israel. And how could he betray the people of God by letting them know that he's having these kinds of questions? And he says that continued until he went into the house of God. He went to church. And he says, when I went to church, then I understood the end of all of these wicked people. He understood that it's not about life as we see it today. It's about eternal life and who'll get there and who will not. And he says, then I understood. When I considered eternity, then I understood. And really, that's the secret for us in these questions, is to understand eternity. That it's not going to go well. I don't care how well it goes in this life, it's not going to go well with the wicked in eternity. There is a heaven, and yes, there is a hell. The righteous, the faithful, will go to heaven. The wicked, the unrighteous, the unfaithful, we'll spend eternity apart from God and all the things that go with being with God. And to be totally apart from God, that is hell. And that is where the unrighteous will end. And we understand that, but still, at the same time, we wonder why in this life do things seem to go so well sometimes with those who are not righteous? The second question that he asks is, how long will the Lord put up with this? You know, that's what Habakkuk wants to know there in Habakkuk chapter 1 and verse 2. He knows that eventually God's patience with these people will run out, but what he wants to know is, why hasn't it already run out? Why is God tolerating these people as they rebel and rebel and rebel and rebel against Him? When's God going to do something about this? How long is He going to tolerate the rebellion of these people? Kind of interesting there, and we'll see it when we study Habakkuk. When God says, oh, here's what's coming. Then Habakkuk starts backing off from that. I don't know what Habakkuk expected God to answer, but when God tells him the Chaldeans are coming and they're going to wipe these people out, that's not evidently what Habakkuk expected to hear. Jeremiah gets the same answer in Jeremiah 12, 7 through 13. God says, I will reach the point. I'm not there yet, but I will reach the point where I am finished with these people, where I am at the end of my rope, where my patience has run out, and then it is going to go very difficultly with these people. But God's answer in verse 5 to Jeremiah is twofold. Like the questions are twofold, the answer is twofold. And first of all, what Jeremiah needs to understand is that God's people live by faith and not by explanations. That's the very foundation of what it means to be a child of God. Not that we have every question answered. Not that everything is totally understandable and we know everything about everything that God is doing. That's not what discipleship is about. Discipleship is about living by faith. Got to thinking about it. You know, I can't think of a single passage where God actually explains himself. When the question is asked, either why do bad things happen to good people, or why do good things happen to bad people, I don't think you'll ever find, I may be missing it, if I am, let me know, but I don't think you'll ever find a passage where God says, okay, I understand your dilemma, now let me explain it to you. See, this is what I'm thinking, and this is what happened, and all those kinds of things. Job's the perfect example of that, isn't it? You know, oftentimes we'll talk about Job and how Job explains to us why the righteous suffer. No, it doesn't. It explains why Job suffered, and we have a front row seat to that. And at the end of the book of Job, we know why Job suffered. But do you realize God never told Job? At least it's not recorded. When Job has all of these questions, and that's what the first 39 chapters are about, is Job pleading with God to tell him why he's going through what he's going through. And God remains silent. Until finally, at the end of Job, God answers. He spends, I think it's three chapters in the book of Job, answering Job. And what God never says to Job is, okay, here's what happened. I had the sons of God were passing before me one day, and Satan was there, and Satan challenged me about you. And I told him, okay, take away his things, and you remain faithful. And Satan challenged me again about you, and I said, you can take his health, but don't take his life. You see, and all of this, and it's wonderful that you stood up. That answer is not there. You know what God spent three chapters telling Job? I know why you're suffering. And you just need to trust me. Just trust me. And realize that you can't have a one-on-one conversation with me. Because even if I explained to you what was going on, you wouldn't understand it anyway. So just trust me. Job is not about why good people suffer. Job is about trusting God even when you are suffering. And really, that's God's explanation to Jeremiah. God doesn't explain it to him. God just says, trust me. There's going to come a time when those who are wicked will be exposed and those who are righteous will be blessed. But until that time comes, don't spend all your time trying to figure it out. Just trust me. Trust me that the righteous will be okay and the wicked will not. That's the first answer. The second answer is, if you are wearied by running with footmen, how will you run with horses? You see, Jeremiah, he had this persecution had already started for him there in Anathath. It had started. The priests were threatening to kill him. This is his small hometown. And the priests are persecuting him now. They're threatening him now. And that's all that he had gone through. And here's what God tells Jeremiah. You hadn't seen the worst of it yet. You think this is bad that the priests in Anathoth have threatened you? Just wait. And what Jeremiah doesn't know is that the king of Israel himself is going to be against what Jeremiah is saying. The religious leaders and the political leaders, the princes in Jerusalem are going to be against him. They're going to throw him into a cistern. And he's going to be there in the mud and come close to dying for his stand for God. And here's what Jeremiah says, or what God says to Jeremiah. If Anathoth is wearing you out, how are you going to put up with Jerusalem? How are you going to make it through that cistern if you can't make it through some threats from these people who are standing against God? And so we look at that and we ask ourselves, if we're not willing to be faithful to God through any kind of minor inconveniences that we might have to go through right now, how do we expect that we will fare when we have to meet like first century Christians in secret, underground, with the lights off, in order to avoid persecution, maybe even death, for what we're doing here this morning? If somebody looking at us wrong, or somebody saying something that hurts our feelings, if that throws us all into a dither, how are we going to handle it when we are beaten and thrown into prison for our faith? And it could very well be, as Ron mentioned, I think in the Bible class this morning, that time could very well come. How are we going to handle it? If we can't handle things right now, how are we going to handle it then? Again, if somebody looks at us wrong, or things aren't going exactly like we want them to go, how are we going to handle it when those who we have considered our friends become our enemies and threaten our life? You see, what God wants Jeremiah to know is that he has no right to reach the end of his rope. Not now, not when he's in a cistern, not when it looks like he's going to die. Getting to the end of the rope is God's business, not ours. Our business is to stay faithful to God, to trust in him, yea, though he may slay us. How are you faring in that? Is the way you react to things now indicative of the way you'll react when and if things get a lot worse? It's not good to contemplate, or it's not fun to contemplate things getting worse. But we always have to contemplate them. And look at our own lives in that contemplation. And say, what do I need to shore up? What problems are there with me and maybe my attitudes and my character that I need to shore up so I will always be prepared? No matter what happens, I'll always be prepared for when that day might come. There are three things about trials that Jeremiah needed to understand that we need to understand. The first of all is that life will have trials. If you're expecting to get through life without trials as a disciple of Jesus Christ, sorry. Peter said that's not going to happen. 1 Peter chapter 4 and verse 12, "Beloved, do not think it strange concerning the fiery trial which is to try you." Now this church hasn't gone, the church that Peter is writing to, or the church is, hasn't gone through the kind of persecution that eventually they are going to go through. And Peter says, trial is coming, fiery trial is coming, unlike anything that you have seen before. And he says, in this you greatly rejoice, though now for a little while, if need be, you have been grieved by various trials. That what? That the genuineness of your faith, being much more precious than gold that perishes, though it is tested by fire, may be found to praise, honor, and glory at the revelation of Jesus Christ. Paul says there in 1 Peter chapter 4, don't be surprised when the trials come. And he says in 1 Peter 1 and verse 6 that there is a benefit to this. And that's really the second point that we have here. Small trials prepare us for those big trials that are to come. That's what James says there in James chapter 1 and verse 2 when he says that that people need to understand in going through the trials that we go through that there is joy to be found in that because these trials prepare us for trials that are to come. They produce patience in us for those times to come when greater trial comes. And every time I read James chapter 1, what James has to say, and 1 Peter chapter 4, and 1 Peter chapter 1, it reminds me of David and his battle with Goliath. David is the face behind these principles of counting it joy, all joy when trials come, of being patient through the trials. Here is young David, and he is about to fight this 9-foot-9-inch giant of a man, a trained warrior. David's the shepherd boy. And all of Israel shrinks back, but David is willing to go and fight Goliath. And King Saul wants to know how he could muster up the courage to do this. How are you going to do it, David? And here's David's answer. Fought a lion one time. Killed that lion. And after that, I fought a bear. And I killed a bear. And if I could kill a lion and I could kill a bear, if God could see me through that, what is this? He doesn't say 9-foot-9-inch decked out giant. He says, what is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should taunt the armies of the living God? Think about that a minute. Lion and a bear weren't uncircumcised. God didn't require that of them. Lion never taunted God. Bear never taunted the enemy or the army of God. And he said, yet God delivered me. The lion and the bear were just doing what naturally comes to lions and bears. They were looking for a meal. And David engages in hand-to-hand combat with them. And he kills them. But what he says there is, God delivered me from the hand of the lion and the hand of the bear. And God's going to deliver me in the same way from this uncircumcised Philistine who taunts the armies of the living God. David didn't gripe about the trial of the lion and the trial of the bear. He saw in that an opportunity to strengthen his faith, or to prepare him for something that we would probably think was even a greater battle, and that is against this 9-foot-9-inch decked-out Philistine who is taunting the armies of God. Small trials prepare us for big trials. Third lesson, only faith we can count on is faith that holds up under whatever trials come. Again, 1 Peter chapter 1, verses 6 and 7. What Peter says there in that passage is that the faith that we have and that we have when we go through these trials, the faith that we exhibit there is a proof to us is a proof to us that our faith is strong, that our faith is genuine. The only faith that we can count on is the faith that is proven by the trials that we go through. You go through a trial, don't let it cause you to come to the end of your rope. Don't let it cause you to lose patience. See the value in it. And let it strengthen you for those greater trials that will come to your life. Why does the way of the wicked prosper? And why does the way of the righteous sometimes not prosper? You know, I don't know. I'll tell you who does know. God knows. But here's the thing that I do know. I know that if I put my life in His hands, in the end, none of all of that will matter. It won't make any difference what I have to go through in this life or what the unrighteous get to enjoy in this life. None of that will make any difference. Because in the end, this is about whether or not we go to heaven when this life is over. I want to go to heaven. And so I'm going to endure the trials of life to the best of my ability. I'm never going to get to that point, hopefully, where I come to the end of my rope. And I know you want to go to heaven too. And my hope, my prayer for you is that you'll never come to that point where you reach the end of your rope. And that all of your patience runs out. And you ask, as Asaph asked long ago, what's the benefit? What good is it to serve God? It is always good to serve God. And that's our lesson for this morning. Perhaps there's someone in our audience this morning who has gone through the trials of life. And you tried to go through those trials all on your own. And you found out how useless it is to try to explain those trials on your own, to try to go through them and to conquer those on your own. Our invitation to you is, begin this morning leaning on God and letting Him see you through those trials. Here's how you do it. You obey the gospel of Jesus Christ. You become a Christian. And then you lean on the hope and the joy that is yours because of the forgiveness of your sins and the contemplation of eternal life that you have as a result of that faith that you have placed in God. Can we help you to do that this morning? Help you in any way? In your service to God, let us know how we can do so by coming forward right now while together we stand and sing.